From the bizarre world of the paranormal to the sinister secrets of the U.S. government, the Black Vault has become known worldwide as the premier spot for anything and everything conspiracy. Now, join me, John Greenwald Jr., as we dive into the research together in hopes to decipher these mysteries. This is the Black Vault Radio. That's right, this is the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr. Thank you so much for making the Black Vault Radio your podcast of choice. I hope you're listening via the Black Vault Radio Network, or BVRN. If you're not, you should definitely check it out. Just log on to www.blackvaultradio.com. You'll see about 40 shows now syndicated throughout the globe, one of which is the one you're listening to right now, the Black Vault Radio. I'm really sorry, though, for the lack of shows in the last couple of months. I've received your letters. I've got lots of listeners out there that are writing in wondering if I'm dead, if I'm around. I am, and I do apologize. The last show being last November, it's embarrassing. I don't even want to talk about it. Unfortunately, the schedule has just been insane for me, and I can blame our guest. In a respectful way, I should say. You've seen the show on the History Channel. It's called UFO Hunters. One of the stars of the show, Bill Burns, will be joining me in just a couple of minutes. We're going to chat about our time together on Season 3. Ask Bill, it may have been too much time together. We had an amazing time, though. Joking aside, we did have a great time together. Bill is one knowledgeable man on the topic of UFOs and what I learned in the field. So many other topics as well. We're going to talk about his background, his work on Season 3. We'll probably throw in some questions on Season 1 and 2. And we'll talk about the future of UFO hunters. So stay tuned for that. Now, since I last broadcasted to you all, there have been some pretty huge changes to the Black Vault website. Now, you may be listening through a syndicated radio network. That's fine. You may not know what the Black Vault is. That's okay, too. I invite you to visit. It is different than the Black Vault Radio Network, which I just talked about. This is the Black Vault. This is kind of the first website that started it all. It started now about 13 years ago. And I was 15 at the time. I created a website that started as an archive of declassified government documents, but now it's morphed into quite a bit more. If you log on to www.theblackvault.com, you will see a link to the Black Vault community. That is the main portal of this site. And on it, you will see not only the document collection, but now you have the option to meet thousands of people from around the globe who have joined the site. It's all for free. Don't worry about hidden charges or anything like that. It's absolutely free to join. But some of the new features, if you haven't seen the site lately or at all, an audio-video chat room, again, also for free. Think about it. Talk via webcam or with a microphone, just like a telephone, online for free to anybody who is registered on the site. You will have a message form that's also recently redesigned. You'll have to pop into that, see how many categories, how many posters there are. There's hundreds of new posts every single day to read. There's a photo archive, a video archive. The Black Vault Television, or the blackvault.tv website, has taken off since we last talked. Hundreds and hundreds of videos are able to be downloaded for free. Even upload your own. The Black Vault Encyclopedia Project, hundreds and hundreds of new articles. That's a proven stat. You can check out the recent changes. Hundreds of new articles to read, case files from around the world, MUFON submissions from the Mutual UFO Network, case management system database, and again, most of the case files are complete with photographs and videos and evidence files, all to download. It is a pretty big creation. So pardon the plug, but I had to update you on some of the new features to the Black Vault. Bottom line, you just gotta log on and join. Again, it's free, but check it out, because I don't think you will be disappointed at all. Nor will you with this show. Bill Burns, one of the stars of UFO Hunters on the History Channel, coming up on the Black Vault Radio. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr. Joining me on the line is Mr. Bill Burns, Dr. Bill Burns, actually, I should say, UFO hunter, literary agent, publisher. You know his name from UFO Magazine. He really needs no introduction. Bill, thank you so much for joining me here on the Black Vault Radio.
Hi, John. It's my pleasure, and it's really great to hear your voice again, having heard it in my ear for the past 5 months.
That's right. For those who don't know, I started last December on season 3 of UFO Hunters as one of the producers, one of the show producers. There was about 4 of us, and we just had a great time with Bill, Pat Uskert, and new character this season, Kevin Cook, who joined the UFO Hunters team. Bill, it really was a pleasure. I think we got fairly close in the field. I mean, who wouldn't when you spend 5 months together, practically living on top of each other and spending 12, 14, 16 hours a day with each other. You're the first thing I saw when I got up, and unfortunately the last thing I saw before I went to bed. So we got a lot of experiences throughout the last 5 months to share, and quite a few really fun stories that were a little unexpected. What was your experience like on season 3?
Well, you're right. One of the things that really struck me was how close to a college dorm this was. So,
that's right.
You know, like you went to your or a fraternity house where you went to your rooms at night, but literally you were in each other's faces from the time the sun came up till well after sundown. And if anybody told me that basically 50 years after college, being in a college fraternity house, after 50 years, I would wind up at another college fraternity house as a pledge, I would say you're crazy. But this was exactly like being in a fraternity house or in some bizarro version of summer camp.
You know, I must say that I wasn't with you that 100% through the 5 months, but there was a couple guys where you were really on top of each other for 5 months, and that includes Kevin and Pat. How was that? Was it tough for you? Was it easy to get used to, or what was your experience like?
Well, since it was season 3, it was very easy to acclimate. One of the things that happens, and we've been through this now for 3 seasons, is that when you break, it really is a break. And it's one thing to break. I mean, after season 1's break, my wife and I were living, we were still living in Los Angeles. You know, we have a place there. We live on a boat. And so we're still in our boat / condo. And it was a break because it was in March when the first season ended. We ended, in fact, we were in L.A. for the last show, which was the NASA Files with Jack Hasher. And we were in L.A., and then the show ended, and, you know, that was it. We didn't know what our future was going to be because the network, after season 1, they had green-lighted us for season 2 when actually we were at John Schuessler's house in Colorado with Donna Hare and John Schuessler in that episode. In fact, it was the NASA episode, and we'd gotten green-lighted, and then we went to England. We did the Cops episode there, which really was a poor episode. And the network pulled the green light and said, no, we're reconsidering this. We don't like the ratings. Typical network. And we didn't know until six weeks into the spring. And then that was it. Season 2 started that summer. And then at the end of season 2, same thing. We got no word on how we were doing during season 2, except we knew we were doing over a 1. We knew the ratings were high for History Channel, so we knew that. And we knew that some of the final shows were really hitting them out of the park, even if it was just out of the park. And so we got the shows were still running. That's the funny part about it, because season 2 was so late after season 1. The shows were still running right through Thanksgiving when we were green-lighted right before Thanksgiving for season 3. And the funny thing was that the best shows from that season that we did were the final ones, Needles and, Crash and Retrievals, Kecksburg and Needles, and Area 51, which actually did as well as The Real Housewives of New York and then The Real Housewives of New Jersey, and we beat Nurse Jackie in the ratings. So, I mean, in that respect, we really did well. And then your Dulcie episode, which I think was You know, and I'm not saying this to be gratuitous. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this honestly because we had the time to do the show right, and you were flexible enough as a writer and a producer to recognize that when Gabe Valdez popped up with those photographs, that something really great was going to happen in the episode. So that's really a credit to you. Again, you really kind of have to be in the UFO community to know when something good is going to happen.
That's right.
And I mean, you really do. I mean, we both knew the story of Gabe Valdez. We both knew the story of cattle mutilations. We both knew the story of this kind of alien hybrid, one of the pieces of lore in ufology. Since we both knew that, we could look at each other across Gabe Valdez's photos and say, dude, this is something.
Yeah. And so, and let me interject, because just so the listeners know, season 3 episode number 2 was mine, one I got to produce and kind of create from just a paragraph, and it was on the alleged Dulce installation in Dulce, New Mexico, which is this base. Bottom line is this base where there's some type of secret operation between humans and aliens doing secret genetic experiments. I'll be honest with you, Bill. I had no idea really what to expect from this episode. I just thought we wouldn't find anything. And when you referenced Gabe Valdez, we were doing an interview with one of the New Mexico state troopers who really is infamous in the Dulce lore, in the UFO legend, as being instrumental in investigating the cattle mutilations through the 60s and 70s, really doesn't buy into the whole alien theory. But he comes out with these photographs from a case he investigated of what was, in his own words, a hybrid of not only a cow, but also with other animal parts in it. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And he had pictures and everything, and that made it to air, which I was kind of shocked at. But it was a very interesting tie-in to the Dulce legend.
That's right. And one of the fascinating things about that, and I think Kevin Cook picked up on it in his, I mean, you know, basically for the audience, you know, we really are kind of talking TV shop, but still, one of the things that Kevin Cook noted was that bovine and human chemistry is very close.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right, because if you notice, just oddly enough, one of the folks that I know from the club where we live in L.A., it's a yacht club, and, you know, where the average age is 100, one of the people there is having a new aorta valve put in. It's kind of a bypass,
mm-hmm.
and it's occluded. And so his choice was, and I'm not kidding you, his choice was from the cardiac surgeon, do you want to go artificial or do you want to go bovine?
Wow.
Because they could use a bovine aorta with the appropriate kinds of drugs, obviously the anti-immunization drugs, so that his own body's white cells don't fight the new body part, they could actually harmonize that, make that invisible to his immune system so it's as if it's his own, but it's bovine.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when later on, and it's funny because you were the producer for both, when we spoke to Nancy Talbot in Trenton for Trace Evidence.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And
right?
She brought it up.
The first thing she said was, guys, you know, you're not looking at the reality of this, that bovine serum is used for in vitro fertilization. So here we are in these episodes that are close, and you're the producer on both, suddenly getting this plug-in, no pun intended, about the value of bovine parts, and then you look at what Gabe Valdez, so quite frankly, you don't need to have any extraterrestrials or aliens or anybody to be doing that kind of experimentation with hybridizing various species, because bovine serum and human serum are so close, and you could actually see a pharmaceutical company. I mean, it's an unspeakable experiment in terms of what we deem to be morality, but you could actually see a pharmaceutical company in league with some agency, I don't think it's the FDA, but in league with some agency in a secret government, developing all kinds of, and I could see this for the military. You know, you need to have replaceable body parts, not because you're building the android soldier, not because you're building some kind of Terminator-type soldier for the future. You want to have a stock of somatic parts for muscles and joints and all kinds of things. So what's the best way to do it? Hybridize a human and a bovine and give yourself, using stem cells, give yourself this like stock of parts that you can have in a deep freeze, that if you're in the middle of the battlefield and somebody gets shot through the heart, hey, guess what? Here's a heart. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it's an absolute fascinating topic, and you bring up an interesting point because we really can't, in a one-hour show, which comes down to about 45 minutes and 20 seconds or so of actual content, we can't cover everything. And that's what's very tough, Bill, for you and I, because you and I both know how much should be in shows like this, and something on cattle mutilations or something like Dulce or something like Trace Evidence, all those different types of shows cannot be done in 45 minutes. And so we always get those letters. I'm sure you get them as well. Oh. Hey, you missed this. Hey, you missed that. And it's like, well, we didn't, unfortunately, in production and television production, the expression is it's like cutting off your baby's left arm, as morbid as that sounds, especially when you're talking about Dulce, as morbid as that sounds, it really is what you have to do in the very end, because you spend months and months researching, writing, then going out shooting. And we're shooting, what, about 15 hours an episode, something like that, with cameras?
I actually asked our DP, Kevin Graves, and he said we're shooting between 20 and 25 hours per episode to get down to 43 minutes.
And that is absolutely insane. You know, and a lot of people don't know how much goes into a show like this. And then when it comes down to it, when we did Dulce, when we were in the edit bay, you were, I know, off shooting another episode. And we had talked a few times about Dulce in the interim while we were actually editing this thing down, but we were about 40 minutes long, which means we had two shows in that one show, and what we had to do was just sit there, listen to it, and cut it down, and it really is very, very tough.
Now, and in fact, for the folks out there who don't know, one of the things we cut, which was sad, but I understand why it was cut, and I really got a ton of email about this. We cut the tribal elders,
yeah.
And we cut the tribal elders talking about the little people. And you're right, that could have been really, we could have split Dulce into two shows and had two really strong shows, especially if that second show focused on kind of the little people that the members of the Jicarilla tribe were seeing running around schoolyards and playgrounds and things like that, and the strange shadow figures that that even Kevin Graves thought he saw at the hotel that were populating the area. And that was sad. I mean, I think that was worthy of its own show, but you know what? We only had 13 episodes, and knowing what we know now, we could have actually done a double episode on Dulce, knowing what we know now.
Absolutely. And you know, not a day goes by where I don't regret having to cut that scene. Unfortunately, it was for time, like you said. But there was so much unbelievable information that came out. Now, so everyone understands, the town of Dulce, New Mexico, is on the Jicarilla Apache Indian Nation reservation, which means we had to go through a lot of hoops to actually get on and shoot on the property. But while we were there, the elders invited us into their homes, into their places that they gather, and told us some amazing stories. We've got to take a break here on the Black Vault Radio. We're talking to Bill Burns from UFO Hunters on the History Channel. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday night, and it plays all the time. But we'll be back with Bill. We'll talk about these little people and what else the elders said, and you make up your own mind on what's really going on in Dulce, New Mexico. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr. Joining me on the show, very exciting hour, Bill Burns from UFO Hunters, star of the show. Bill, it was a pleasure working with you as a producer on your show. It was a great pleasure for me. We've known each other for quite a long time, but after those 5 months, we got to know each other quite a bit more and got to pretty much live with each other in Dulce, New Mexico, investigating the Dulce base that has been infamously in UFO legend for quite some time. And we found out quite a bit more than we bargained for. We mentioned Gabe Valdez before the break and the really bizarre pictures of a cow/human hybrid. Those are his own words that really tied into the mystery, even though he didn't buy into the alien connection. And you also bring up the Native American elders. Go into a little bit more detail, though. What did you learn from them about these little people?
Well, what's so astounding to me is, I mean, you know that Dulce has been lore, and it's been lore for 20 years. And we actually had a great time, in addition to the elders that I'll get back to, in talking to Ken Storch and Bob X, the undercover person, the undercover cop, who were confronted by police right outside of Dulce, who told them when they asked about the goings-on at the base, I can't talk about that. And one of the things that Gabe Valdez made very clear to us was that he couldn't talk about it either. He showed us photos of strange-looking helicopters with strange kind of insignia on them, which made absolutely no sense to me, but there they were. And he even said he couldn't talk about them because the consequences to the Jicarilla Nation, the Jicarilla Apache Nation, would be too intense, and the Jicarilla have to stand up for themselves. I mean, I learned so much, I have to say. I mean, one of my thoughts when talking to members of the tribe and that little girl we spoke to who was always joining us at breakfast was, and I say this not to, again, I'm trying not to be gratuitous, politically correct, but I want to say, what did we do to these people? You know, there were times looking at what was going on that I felt so extraordinarily guilty about really what ancestors of ours had done, the broken treaties, the wars, the wiping out the women and children. When you realize going back 300 years, what Europeans did to the Native Americans, literally robbing them of a past, robbing them of their land. We gave them casinos. And yet, when you talk to the elders, and I was so happy to be invited by them to have us all go in to that tribal hall and talk to them. They were you know, it's like you get the sense that you're talking to old souls,
mm-hmm.
people, you know, souls who've been in this life again and again and again. And they were, besides the kindness that came with age, and even though some of them were younger than I was, they acted older because they'd been here before. It was their actual security in knowing who they were and why they were here and what their purpose was, and that their understanding about the whole nature of the universe was actually, in some respects, it was very different from ours, but they were secure in that knowledge in ways that we are not, because we're being frantic, we're running around. The whole sense of time was different. And when they began talking about the little people as present, and how they described it was these small, dark, grayish, dark creatures. They looked like children. They were playing on swings. They were hanging around the schools, and they could see them. It's like that John Carpenter movie, They Live. They could see them. And, of course, we couldn't, and it would have been great to have stayed around, to lived with them, to have gone to the lodge and basically tried to see the same creatures they did. But what I learned mainly was much more about our role as Europeans in North America and that community of the Jicarilla and their great sense of who they are and why they're here, and their acceptance of UFOs, and their even acceptance of the fact that whoever put the base in Dulce, and I do believe there's a base in Dulce, there's something there, that whoever put that there, whether it were the extraterrestrials, whether it was the star people, whether it was the U.S. military, whether it was some kind of pharmaceutical conglomerate, whatever it was, they had a level of acceptance of it that they understood that even though they might be doing some dark things there, some nefarious things there.
Hold on, Bill. I've got to interrupt you. I apologize. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour. We got to take a break. More with Bill Burns, UFO Hunter, when we return right here on the Black Vault Radio. You're listening to BVRN. The Black Vault Radio Network. Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I'm laughing because during the break, Bill and I were talking. He is so used to me interrupting him. I always apologize to whomever is joining me on the air because when those breaks come up, they're hard-coded. I have to break. They're timed in. And Bill's so used to it that in the field, I had to interrupt him all the time while we were shooting. And anybody who is listening that did see us shooting out there in the field, any MUFON members or whomever may have been watching, I had to interrupt poor Bill so many times, not including Pat and Kevin as well, I think I stopped apologizing because I apologized so many times. But Bill, here we are again, back on the air, and here I am interrupting you yet again and again. So I apologize for that.
It's the basis of our relationship.
That's right. That's right. That's why we get along so well. That being said, though, you're talking about the Native American elders of the Jicarilla Apache Nation who really did invite us in. They were telling us some amazing stories, and they bring up these little people. Now, as you describe them, very short, and even they describe them as having bushy hair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you walk away from that, and you're hearing this from not one or two people, but multiple people who've had encounters and had sightings of these little people, what are you led to believe?
Well, you have to wonder whether the Jicarilla are able to see into another dimension, or are these creatures who actually manifest themselves visually only to them? Because we were hanging around there at night. It's not as though we went to our rooms and kind of hid under our beds. We were going out. We were shooting. We
mm-hmm.
were, you know, on the road. And we didn't see them. And, of course, nobody pointed them out. And had we had more time, I'm sure we would have tried to go to the very spots where the elders said they were. But what astounded me was that we had one great pickup interview when we were splitting cast, and Pat and Kevin were going up the mesa, right, in that cat,
mm-hmm.
up the mesa to explore it with their guide, and I was heading back to base, ostensibly heading back to base. We were talking with John Lear, and about the whole nature of what was going on at Dulce. And what was so great was that it would have been wonderful to have seen the little creatures for ourselves, but we just didn't have time to do that. But this one interview we had actually described seeing this young man describe being followed by a UFO when he was in a car with his mom. I don't think that was in the show.
No.
And didn't make the cut. And he was followed by a UFO. They went to the police station, the tribal police station. The tribal police officer saw the UFO. And then he talked about seeing a little person when he was off the reservation and describing it. And he was told, don't play around at night. In other words, the night is not for you. It's for them. And that's when he saw this little creature. And that blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would have loved to have explored that. We didn't have the time to do it. What we came away with was some astounding stuff. What we came away with was actual photographic evidence. I can't call it proof, but I can call it photographic evidence that in that area, something is going on with mutilated cattle. And we know that one of the hallmarks, one of the crime scene pieces of crime scene evidence for a mutilated cow was that the womb was cut open. And now we kind of think we know why, that inside the womb there is something gestating, which is this kind of hybrid creature, or it was. And you could come up with any kind of theory you want to as to the source of that and the why of that. Nancy Talbot told us that the why of that was it was pharmaceutical companies and they're testing for mad cow disease, that the entire beef stock is basically infected.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that it's an alien-human hybrid. You could say the military and the pharmaceutical companies are working together to develop somatic parts that are replacement parts for soldiers and for humans as well. You can say a lot. But that, to me, was the mind blower, as well as the little people that are walking around there
yeah.
and appearing. That image of that entity inside that womb really said that something was really going on there. I would have loved to have seen Norio, who was one of our guests, Norio Hayakawa. I would have loved to have seen his expression looking at those photos.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, they were absolutely amazing to put your eyes on, because it was like you were completely grossed out at first, and I don't mean that like ew, blood. It was the idea of what that really was. I mean, that it was just repulsive in itself.
Right. I mean, there's a human skull. That was clearly a human embryonic skull, a fetus, on top of what was an animal body. And it was shocking.
And the ear, I think, was the most eerie part for me. The ear did resemble a human ear. I wish I was making that up, but unfortunately, I wasn't. And this was coming from, what amazes me is that it was coming from a New Mexico state trooper, number one. So that in itself holds some value. But also, the man who does not believe. He was the show's biggest skeptic. I hate the S word, but he was our show's biggest skeptic, as he did not buy into any secret base, quote unquote, where there's aliens working with humans on genetic experiments, like the legend says. He didn't buy into any of that. And yet the evidence that he saw was probably the strongest piece of evidence to support that theory. I mean, that in itself was pretty amazing.
Absolutely. And what's so fascinating about comparing Dulce for a second to Area 51 are the two great legends of the alien firefights, right? I mean, you know from the whole debates over Area 51 between Bob Collins and Rick Doty and whatever. I forget the other name of the person, this kind of mysterious person that's supposed to be Rick Doty's alter ego. But from all these discussions, that there was this battle at the gate when an alien tried to get away between the guards at Area 51, the soldiers at Area 51, and this alien, and folks died in that encounter. That was at Area 51 in Nevada. And, of course, in Dulce, there is the legend, and John Lear told us about this, and he said Tom Costello, who was a security guard, told Ann about it, who was his friend, who also had her own problems, said that there was a firefight when soldiers went down to a level where Earth scientists, us human scientists, were getting a lecture from the aliens, and there was an encounter, a hostile encounter there. We weren't allowed to bring weapons there. The aliens retaliated. We retaliated their retaliation, and there were human deaths as a result of that firefight. So you've got that, and that says a lot about Dulce, whether that's true, whether that is lore, whether that is straight disinformation, I don't know. I mean, if I were a pharmaceutical company and I were doing some very, very unholy, but at least to my mind, necessary experiments working with the military or some agency of the government, I would for sure concoct an alien cover story to send people like the Norio Hayakawas and the UFO hunters and the Kens and the Bobs off in the wrong direction. I would do that.
Yeah, I agree. And look what it does to many people. I mean, after I visited, I will say my mind changed a little bit. Do I believe the aliens are working with humans in a secret installation? I don't know. But before I did this show, I will say I was just not laughing at the legend, but you kind of dismiss it. I mean, you hear something this wild and you go, okay, that's ridiculous, you know, and the stories of Phil Schneider, which did not make it into the show for multiple reasons, but we did look into Phil Schneider. That was one thing that did not make it in.
You have to.
Yeah, exactly. And there's just so much to this legend, but when we got there on the ground, and I'm going to go back to the little people, because this brings up my most memorable time, Bill, and I had to say this on the air, that while we were there, we interviewed John Rhodes as well. John Rhodes being infamous really kind of progressing with the Dulce investigation and research throughout the last decade, because he's come out with documents from the Rand Corporation and he's done his homework. I mean, he was the man to talk to about this. And off camera, you and I and John Rhodes go out fairly late at night in Dulce and went exploring. And I don't know if you recall, but when we were on that road covered with snow, it was lots of snow there in northern New Mexico when we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the footprints that I still have pictures of?
Yes, and, I do. And I couldn't, I mean, we're staring at them.
Mm-hmm.
And for the life of me, not that I'm a tracker, but I just couldn't figure out what they were.
Right. And for the listeners, because radio, unfortunately, I can't show you the photographs, mm-hmm. although I will bring them up. I'll link them on the blackvaultradio.com website, where many of you are going to be listening. If you're on a syndicated channel, just head to blackvaultradio.com, click on the Black Vault Radio link, look for this show with Bill Burns. You'll get a link to that photograph. To describe them, though, Bill, they were just little feet. Now, I'm not a tracker either, but I will say I'm a fairly avid hiker. I go hiking all the time. I use the word loosely, but have tracked deer, and I've seen bear. You name the animal, I've seen it here in Southern California, and have had run-ins with them. Unfortunately, not a mountain lion, but pretty much everything else. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a track like this in snow,
well,
which was amazing.
Well, that's what impressed me is, you know, no pun intended, you stopped in your tracks.
Yes, that's right.
And so I was saying, and at first, I couldn't figure out what was so fascinating to you, because you just stood there, right?
Yeah. And I mean, what more could you say when you're hearing these stories? And when you're out in the dark of northern New Mexico, snow all around, you're in an area you don't know.
And it was scary.
And it was a little scary. When you see these tracks out there and you don't see paw prints, you don't see nails, you don't see toes, you don't see anything. They were just like little, like if you took an infant's foot, you know, a very small baby's shoe and put it into the snow, that's what it was like. But it didn't look like a normal, I guess you would call that a gait of a human, where it was right foot, left foot, right foot. The feet were very close together the way that they were walking in the snow, and I think that was the eerie part for me. What
right.
it means, I don't know.
I remember you saying that because you kept on saying, you know, what could have, and I you know, it's funny, again, you're more experienced at looking at tracks than I am, and I couldn't understand until you explained it to me, or you actually explained it to John Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
What was so fascinating to you about the separation between the steps?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, with those feet that small, I mean, no one that's going hiking is going to be that small. Nobody brings their child that small to go hiking. And again,
right.
this wasn't, you know, a deer. I mean, you start thinking of all those things that you might see in northern New Mexico that would leave a print of any kind. And I'm here to tell you, I haven't seen anything like it. I'd love for any listener who sees these photographs, if you go, oh, it's this or oh, it's that.
Yeah,
please,
that'd be great.
Please,
that'd
by all
great.
Means, tell us.
Yeah, and the thing that was so surprising to me, once I heard you and John talking about it, was the fact that whatever this was, it was moving under its own power. And I don't mean, you know, I mean, it's not like you're seeing stroller wheel tracks, but it's like, it's obvious this thing was moving purposefully
mm-hmm.
through the snow, and that however small it was, and it was not a four-footed creature, that's the other thing.
Right.
It was clearly bipedal. This thing was moving purposefully under its own power, and there was a kind of a volition to it because there was a direction to these footprints. These were not random tracks. They were going to something.
Yeah, and they weren't in on the road, meaning they weren't just traveling on the road. They came off the road from an area you definitely wouldn't really want to find yourself hiking in late at night, and off, and that was it. They just kind of disappeared. The last thing I'll throw out there is the guide who took us to Archuleta Mesa when we shot with Pat and Kevin up top. The guide was an experienced tracker from the Jicarilla Apache tribe.
Mm-hmm.
He was a tracker. Now, I can say it, Bill can say it, anybody can say, oh, we've never seen tracks like this. This man was a tracker, and he looked at my photographs, and he just kind of smiled and shook his head. He had absolutely no idea what these things were. He said he'd never seen them. Those are
right.
his words. I know you'll have to take my word for it because that wasn't anything that was on camera. This was all behind the scenes stuff. But to hear that is pretty amazing. He had no reason to lie.
He had not only, well, and the funny thing is you told me about it. When you were talking about this, and of course, I know the guide because it was his daughter that was the problem, and we had to take her to the firehouse, and she had to make her confession to the fire chief about setting off the alarm in the
hotel
in the casino. thing with him was that I think he knew what the tracks were, and he certainly was not going to tell you.
That's right.
I mean, that was my impression, because remember when Pat and Kevin asked him to see some of the other mysterious sites of the Mesa, he said he absolutely wouldn't show them.
Right.
So although the Jicarilla were our hosts, and although they were friendly, I think that the Jicarilla themselves were guarding a secret. And I think they were guarding a secret because of what Gabe Valdez said, that somehow the Jicarilla, the consequences for that secret would fall upon the Jicarilla more heavily than they would fall upon anybody else. And so let's just say that there was a history to these little creatures and that they knew exactly who they were, where they were, and why they were. Unless we stayed there for a while, we would not know that. And just like, I forget our guides. I want to say it's Richard, but I'm
Richard,
not sure.
Right. No, you're right, Richard.
Richard, unless we were kind of in the know, he would not show us the other parts of that mesa where he'd seen strange things. And remember, part of the story was that he'd heard noises from inside the mountain, of groaning.
Yeah, there was noises and also holes or vents, the way that they described them. And for those of you who have yet to see the show or have seen it, you'll remember the part where we went up there and looked for these holes or vents and didn't find anything. But the unfortunate thing with the world of television is when you get that green light, and Bill knows more than I do, you get the green light, you go. That's what you have to do. And unfortunately, the green light came for this show during a very bad time for weather, and we just had to do it. We had to go at a very bad time, and unfortunately, we didn't find the vents. But
right, and you know the network was thinking about moving the show up, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they basically flipped it with another episode so as to move it up, and this became, what was it, episode 2 or 3?
It became episode 2, and it was 3.
It was 3, it became 2. And again, the doing post-production on a show like this is very, very tough because there's so much information you basically have to cut. Good information. It's like you're not cutting chaff, you're cutting wheat. And to move it up from 3 to 2 meant that you lose something like 4 weeks of post-production time.
Yeah, exactly. And that really did hurt in a way. Now, the show was great. I really, really was proud of it.
Great. We beat Real Housewives.
Yeah.
I mean, it was one of the best shows. That and Area 51 were probably among the two strongest UFO hunter shows the network ever aired, and they were thrilled with it.
Yeah, and that's great to hear because it's the fans that are listening, Bill. You've got a lot of fans out there. We're coming up to some music here. We've got to take a break. But when we return, I want to ask you about season 4.
Sure.
Even though I was a producer on the show, you're a little bit more in the know. There's a lot of rumors floating around out there on the internet. Is there going to be a season 4? Is there a season 4? There's even a petition flying around that I want you all to sign. We'll give you that link when we return right here on the Black Vault Radio with UFO hunter Bill Burns. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. This hour has flown by with UFO hunter Bill Burns talking about his experience on season 3 of UFO Hunters. It was quite a joy working with Bill and the whole team over there at Motion Picture Production and the History Channel on making this season a reality. I only did about three shows of the season. There's about 12 of them. And I had a great time on the three I was able to produce. There was 4 producers. We all got a hold of a couple of them to just kind of devote all our time to. Now, Bill, before the break, I mentioned there's a lot of rumors floating around out there about a season 4 of UFO Hunters. I know a lot of people listening to this show would love to see it happen. Is it going to happen?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I spoke to our network executive just the other week, he said, honestly, Bill, dead honestly, and the context was, and I know we're running out of time, but the context was this whole business of the Morristown lights, which kind of was a cloud over the show starting from the from April 1st, actually, when it appeared in a Newsweek blog, that story, because it got the network a little shaky. But we don't have time to go into it, but it's on my blog at UFO at www.ufomag.com. Go to that site, click on blog. And then when you get to the blog on the right side, click on Editor's Blog, scroll down, you'll see my Morristown Lights blog, and that'll explain what happened. But the network, and this is a replay of season 1, the network was, according to them, 98% green-lighting us for season 4. And then kind of in the middle of the season, we hit some rough spots with some of the episodes. And the network said, well, let's hold off on that decision. And the last conversation I had with respect to what I was writing in the Morristown blog on UFO Magazine's blog site was, honestly, Bill, we don't know. We have not made a decision because we need to see how the final 4 episodes, John Greenwald's episode included, which is, I think you weren't the Men in Black episode.
No, mine was where we chased the UFO from, it was called First Response.
First Responder. And again, you know, you lucked out with George Merritt, our guest for that episode.
Yeah.
In that particular, they want to see how those final 4 episodes perform, and that will be the basis of their decision. And that's where it is. So it has not been canceled. The rumor about cancellation came from a few places. One was that the middle episodes didn't do well, and they were waiting for the episodes to bounce back, mm-hmm. and because there'd been such a fluctuation in the ratings, they weren't sure. The other one was the network had all these new shows, which were a very different format from UFO Hunters. The Expedition show, a couple of others, right? A Patton 360. They had all these shows that they wanted to basically introduce and premiere, but the problem was there are just so many hours at night during prime time when they could premiere them.
Yeah.
So something has to move. So our show was on the block to be moved because the ratings weren't as great, and they needed to premiere these shows. But our show held down that Wednesday night block.
Yeah.
And if you look at the sponsors we have, we've got Mercedes, we've got Apple iPhone, we've got Honda, we've got Progressive Insurance. We've got some pretty good sponsors. So the network, on the other hand, is not going to want to lose the ratings by introducing a new show in that time slot.
Well, hopefully,
Pat got demoralized because he basically interpreted something in an email from the exec of the show that was trying to be circumspect and not raise false hopes. And Pat on his Facebook put out, "Oh, the show's being canceled," you know, et cetera, et cetera. That was not true.
Well,
and the show
is
not being canceled.
And the rumors...
It just hadn't been renewed yet, but it was not being canceled.
I hate to interrupt. The rumors flew from there, but unfortunately, we're out of time. Hopefully, though, there is a season four. For everybody listening, UFOMag.com. Bill's got lots of books coming out. Make sure you check him out. Check out UFO Magazine on the newsstands if you haven't already. It's a great magazine, one of the best, if not the best, UFO publications. Bill, thank you so much for joining me on the air and sharing your experiences.
Thanks, John. It was a pleasure, and it's always good to talk to you. Ideally, I will see you this weekend.
Sounds good, my friend. Thanks again,
you.
And thank
Bye-bye.
You all for listening to the Black Vault Radio. We'll see you next time.